The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Weekdays from 4:30. Today
FM. For the week trending, we have Finn McRedmond, columnist with the Irish Times based in London, and Owen Tomás McDermott, Managing Director of the Communications Clinic. Now, on Wednesday morning, when word went about that Taoiseach Leo Varadkar was going to have a special press briefing and that a very big announcement was coming, there was a joke going around that he was going to reveal the whereabouts of Kate Middleton. But it turns out that Finn McRedmond, there are suggestions coming from America, from TMZ, that there is going to be a big announcement from Kensington Palace at 6 o'clock in about 40 minutes' time. Is that true?
There's whispers that there'll be an announcement. I think so tone in the coverage has changed. The humour has gone out of the situation, and I think people are treating the situation with like a lot of caution and gentleness until we find out what the content of the announcement is.
Okay, so there's a gravity has emerged rather than there's been all sorts of jokes in relation to
right,
things.
Exactly. Okay,
so, Owen Tomás McDermott, tell us a little bit about what TMZ is reporting.
TMZ is reporting that there will be a statement at around 6 o'clock this evening where it will outline that Princess Kate went in to hospital in January for a scheduled abdominal surgery and spent 13 days at the London clinic before returning home where she was recruited. We have a doctor, according to TMZ, who said that after that doctors went in for the surgery, that may have found something else, which this again is leading to more of the speculation, and that we're told that the palace are going to get specific quite shortly, so within the next perhaps half an hour, 45 minutes. I would have to say it has become one of the single most discussed stories for the last couple of weeks, and it does fall within the bizarre, unprecedented and unbelievable, perhaps not grotesque, because it has been unprecedented that a royal and a significant senior member of the royal family has disappeared. Never has they disappeared without any sort of explanation before, and Kate has been missing in action since January. So that in and of itself is unprecedented. We also see that it's pretty bizarre and unbelievable that an organisation as big as the royal family can make such a faux pas in relation to the communications and the vacuum of communications around this issue, which gave us all the sense that they were hiding something significant, which in and of itself it leads to curiosity, and or they were making one of the biggest communications mistakes in the history, and that showed gross incompetence. And if we even think about the last couple of days of the releasing of the photograph that was doctored, and then claiming that the princess was in some way an amateur editor of photography was, you know, demonstrably ridiculous. Then as well, the video of her being at the farm market carrying bags, and then the question of, well, if she's able to go to the market and carry bags, is she not able to do an interview? And that is the piece that has always struck me, that a short interview or a short video from Kate would have been able to resolve this issue. It would appear from what TMZ are reporting that that is going to be the solution to this.
And of course, another story from during the week, Finn, was apparently an effort to get her confidential medical records from the hospital that treated her. What actually happened there?
There's an investigation into the idea that some staff at this private hospital were trying to get her medical records. To what end? You know, you would assume for nefarious purposes, to kind of leak it or to be the first person to get it out into the press. So, and it's obviously very, very, very serious. And if, you know, people are found guilty, that's, you know, probably, you know, fireable, certainly, but perhaps criminal, I don't know. And I just think it just shows how intense this story has gotten, how big it's gotten, how it's really the only thing that people are talking about.
Finn, there's an interesting message here from a listener who says, it's a medical issue, she should be allowed privacy, ridiculous right. Discussion again, media are sick these days. But as it actually happens, Finn, I think the media coverage has actually been quite limited. This is a story which has dominated social media, and the amount of speculation that has taken place online completely and utterly outweighs the limited amount of coverage that there has been on broadcast media and in newspapers.
Right, I think that's completely true, and that's just, you know, one of the realities of a world with social media. Stories get out of control much quicker. Things spiral. There's, you know, social media doesn't have the same kind of impulses and regulations, checks and balances as traditional media. And that's why, that's precisely why this story has gone so big. It's not the fault of the newspapers or the broadcasters, as you say. It's kind of like the Wild West of Twitter that's contributing to it. So, but you know, like, it is a story, and news stories require coverage. And but she is also, you know, a young woman with three really young children, we should remember, and is entitled to privacy. So, you know, they're just the questions that the media constantly has to grapple with, right? The kind of existential questions of what the media is for. And I think, yeah, that's what's gone on here.
Well, that's what strikes me as interesting around this as well, because first and foremost, it's just, again, bizarre and unbelievable that the royal family do not have social media experts amongst their advisors who can advise them on how this would go through, because social media is merely another channel of communications between an entity and an audience, one could argue, and they should have had a handle on that. In relation to the rights to privacy, there is an element where we have to remember that a member of the royal family's job is to be in the public eye. It is their role to represent Britain. It is their role to create an image of Britain. It is their role to use their profile to raise the awareness of certain charities. And a member of that family doing their job was not available to do their job. I think it is right there for, let's call them, the shareholders of the royal family to ask, where is our employee? And that's why I bring it back to the lack of, I just can't understand why they could not release some sort of statement outlining the situation earlier, before this vacuum of information came in, and then all of this madness on social media was filling it. And then we see this grotesque and horrible behaviour by the people in the hospital, and that terrible conduct trying to access her files. But that is an outcome of this vacuum, and that is a symptom of this issue.
We'll see what is revealed at the press conference at 6 o'clock this evening. Let's move on to other things, and let's move to our big talking point of the week. We spent the first half hour of the show talking about the incoming Taoiseach. It's expected to be Simon Harris. It's almost virtually certain at this stage that it will be. But what about the manner in which Leo Varadkar surprised everyone with his midweek resignation? A 7-minute statement or so, but let's just hear this extract from it.
My reasons for stepping down are both personal and political. I believe this government can be re-elected, and I believe my party, Fine Gael, can gain seats in the next Dáil. Most of all, I believe the re-election of this three-party government would be the right thing for the future of our country, continuing to take us forward, protecting all that's been achieved and building on it. But after careful consideration and some soul-searching, I believe that a new Taoiseach and a new leader will be better placed than me to achieve that. To renew and strengthen the team, to focus our message and policies, to drive implementation. And after 7 years in office, I don't feel I'm the best person for that job anymore. There are loyal colleagues and good friends contesting local European elections, and I want to give them the best chance possible. And I think they have a better chance under a new leader. I am standing aside in the absolute confidence that the country and the economy are in a good place, and that my colleagues in government from all three parties, Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil and the Greens and the Oireachtas, will continue to work hard for the nation's best interests. On a personal level, I've enjoyed being Taoiseach, leader and a cabinet member since March 2011. I've learned so much about so many things, met so many people who I'd never got to meet, been to places I would never have seen, both home and abroad. And I am deeply grateful for it. And despite the challenges, would wholeheartedly recommend a career in politics to anyone who's considering it.
Oh, and get into politics. See the world. Meet people.
Well, this is certainly a significant part of the role that Leo Varadkar excelled at and seemed to enjoy very much so, being an international statesman. And that given the timing of his resignation, having represented Ireland so well in the US over St. Patrick's Day, it perhaps the timing was particularly right for him. And I think when you do listen to him, in terms of looking ahead to the local and European elections, the vista was not an attractive one for him. And you could understand understand why perhaps he views it as the time being right for him. And it is a very unusual position that a politician gets to choose their own ending.
But the recommendation, though, Finn, to people, get into politics, because you get to meet people you wouldn't otherwise meet. You get to travel to places you wouldn't either go to. I thought people went into politics to change things for the good of everybody else rather than for their own enjoyment.
Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of a slightly sweet and parochial statement, unusual for him. I don't know. People get into politics for all sorts of reasons. I would give Leo Varadkar the benefit of the doubt to believe that he is not so self-motivated. I'm not a cynic about him. But, you know, maybe it was a poor choice of words. And also, it's probably is a good part of politics. He gets to go to the White House. He gets to go for a run with Justin Trudeau. You know,
In fairness, there's a lot of people who've gone into journalism, I think, for looking for the opportunities to who they can meet and the places that they can go as well. But journalism is different to being head of government, I suppose, isn't it? But Owen, the other thing that struck me in relation to that, the minute he mentioned that there were personal reasons, he was opening the door to, again, online media speculation, wasn't he?
He was, and that is, if you can imagine that social media, particularly X or Twitter or whatever we're calling it today, is the town square where people talk and speculate publicly. People talk and speculate publicly about what they suspect the issues are. And I think in relation to something like this for the former Taoiseach or the current Taoiseach, who will soon be the former one, those decisions around his personal matters are personal to him. I think in the political reasons were, you can really begin to make sense of them. When you look for the next 12 months, it was going to be a very, very difficult 12 months for him as Taoiseach, and it may still be a very difficult 12 months for Fine Gael, considering that ahead of the next general election, I think they're losing 11 sitting TDs already before we get to the D-Day on the election. So looking at it from his perspective, and to quote him from the parliamentary party, given he couldn't find anybody to stab in the back, he fell on his own sword.
Listener says, don't be too mean-spirited about Leo Varadkar's comment and travel and meeting people. Fewer capable young people will enter politics due to the justifiable but challenging vilification they receive from the media. I wonder how often, though, is the challenging and vilification really from traditional media, how that compares with what happens online, where, of course, we've had a number of reports recently about the abuse that politicians have been taken late into people like Ciarán Cannon on Monday, saying that he was given up. But Finn, there was also something that Leo Varadkar said in the Dáil when he was responding to Holly Kearns of the Social Democrats that jumped out. He said, I think you're very much a politician of the social media age. And it's not about truth, it's not about information, it's about the clip to post online. Was Leo Varadkar not himself somebody who availed of social media opportunities on a regular basis?
Yeah, I think like any contemporary politician, he obviously had to use social media. So social media is baked into the political landscape. It's inextricable now. I think he is kind of getting towards something that is true about younger politicians, which is that it has really become designed for the internet. You see it in the House of Commons too all the time. You can see when they're doing a big long speech, when they're gearing up to the bit that they want to clip into 30 seconds, hopefully that it will go viral, as that they realize their greatest access to the public. I think the mistake that Leo made there is by using that in a condemnatory way. Like, Holly Cairns is a politician for social media, but that's the logic of modernity demands that, right? That's just what politics is now, and a good politician will be a politician for social media. Whether that's good or bad is, you know, a different question. But yeah, there's no point being, you know, anachronistic about it and holding on to the past.
Oh, absolutely, because if you build on what Finn is saying, that if you look at any successful politician, good or bad, they have always utilised the newest media that they had available to them. Lincoln and the newspapers, FDR and the fireside chats on radio, the Nazis on cinema, Reagan and JFK with TV, Obama and Trump using social. So it is just utilising the newest media in a way to communicate to their audience or to their constituents.
But has it resulted, Owen, perhaps in him making a series of what you might consider gaffes, or also been treated unfairly, so that, for example, he's in the Phoenix Park during one of the lockdowns during a hot summer. He takes his top off and he gets photographed doing that. He goes to an event in England again during lockdown, 2 days before our lockdown ended, and he's at a festival and he's photographed at that. And then things like perhaps, you know, his partner Matt Barrett deciding during the coronation of King Charles in a WhatsApp group of something like 350 people or an Instagram group to do a sort of a Graham Norton style commentary as to what he was watching. Those sort of things didn't help him, did they?
No, but would you blame social media for those things? Perhaps, why, if as the leader of the country would, or a senior politician...
Well, I'm not blaming social media if Matt Barrett decides he wants to live tweet his way through the coronation.
We shouldn't necessarily be blaming the technology for the situation that had happened. So, for example, would either of us, Matt, decide to take off our shirts in the Phoenix Park? That may be greatly, totally unwise. For example, neither of us can keep a straight face now. But for instance on that, so there are those questions on, or should someone go to a music festival when perhaps we weren't allowed it? The fact that that has appeared on social media isn't social media's fault.
We have to take a break. We'll be back with more of The Week Trending with Owen McDermott and Finn McRedmond after this. So, Finn McRedmond, columnist for the Irish Times, is with us from London. Owen Tomás McDermott, MD of the Communications Clinic, is with me here in studio. And let's go back to something from the Oscars, which was, a week and a half ago at this stage. And while we were all very much focused on Cillian Murphy winning the Best Actor award, there was a speech made by one of the winners of one of the Best Foreign Language movie, which was The Zone of Interest. And the director of it, Jonathan Glazer, made a speech in which he lamented the war in Gaza.
Our film shows where dehumanisation leads at its worst. It shaped all of our past and present. Right now, we stand here as men who refute their Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked by an occupation which has led to conflict for so many innocent people. Whether the victims of October... Whether the victims of October the 7th in Israel or the ongoing attack on Gaza, all are victims of this dehumanization. How do we resist? Alexandra Bistron Kaladziejczyk, the girl who glows in the film as she did in life, chose to. I dedicate this to her memory and her resistance. Thank you.
Finn McRedmond, tell us about the extent of the backlash against Jonathan Glazer because of that speech.
There's been a letter co-signed by, an open letter co-signed by over 1,000 Jewish members of the Hollywood machine, basically, some high-profile names, high-profile producers. I'm just looking at the list now: Deborah Messing, Eli Roth, Amy Pascal. So some really serious big heavy hitters on that list. And the open letter is quarrelling with Glazer's idea about refuting his Jewishness for being hijacked. They didn't like the use of the word occupation. That's a very kind of contentious word when discussing Israel-Palestine. And, you know, but I think it's really, in its core, it's a rather simple story, which is that Glazer has every right to go on stage and make his point of view known. And the 1,000 signatories of this letter condemning him have an equal right to make their point known. There's no real greater contention here than that.
But I wonder, Owen, is Glazer going to get cancelled by Hollywood for having been brave enough to use the platform of an Oscar acceptance speech to make comments that many of us who are non-Jewish might well agree with?
Yeah, and I printed it out when I knew we were going to be talking about it to review it, and I looked at it, and again, I must acknowledge from my perspective, I didn't see that there was anything wrong within it. And I think it is probably a classic example that in communication terms, you can really categorise readers, listeners, audiences into three groups. You have the converted who are with you, you have the unconvertible who won't be with you, and then you have the floating voters sitting in the middle. And who people should be trying to influence are the floating voters. And often within this conflict, certainly the pro-Israel side, from my perspective again, I would tend to see that they set out to preach to the converted rather than trying to persuade anybody of their view, and it is not an exercise in persuasion. When I look at Glaser's speech, again, as I said, there was nothing that jumped out at me that I could see, in fact, that I would happen to agree with. But he was remarkable and unique in the use of that platform to put himself and his career at risk to express what many of us would believe to be the right thing to express, particularly when really what now we are simply asking for and what people should be asking for is for it to stop and for it to end, and that we are waking up with horrors in our phones, and we are waking up seeing children dead. We were waking up seeing, like, for example, I saw an image yesterday of a child, mustn't be any more than 6 or 7, and their face blistered and burnt. And they're humans and people, not to mention the statistics of more than 30,000 people dead. Practically the entire population of 3/4 of the population of Gaza displaced. 500,000 of them in serious starvation, the vast majority of them, again, if not all of them, at acute food shortage. Like, that for me is traumatic and is shocking. And that this gentleman made a speech at the Oscars presenting that point of view, from my perspective, again, I saw that there was nothing wrong within it.
It's very hard to follow that with many of the stories that I have in the week trending, because it is so upsetting. So maybe I will actually, by asking you, Finn, to tell us a little bit about the Global Happiness Index, where Ireland is placed on that. And do we need, when we consider what has just been said by Owen, to be maybe getting a grip on ourselves?
Yeah, so the Global Happiness Index has come out saying Finland, I believe, is the happiest country in the world. Ireland has fallen tragically down to number 17. The 10 happiest nations, Finland, Denmark, Iceland, Sweden, you know, list goes on. I can't help but shake the feeling that these lists are kind of a little bit fake and a little bit made up, quantifying happiness, probably remarkably difficult thing to do. Then isolating that by nationality, also a difficult thing to do. I'm not sure if like the kind of ephemeral concept of happiness kind of has a concept of the nation state, but apparently lists like this seem to imply that it does. Ireland's fallen, plenty of reasons, economy, politics, the malaise in politics, social media is always cited in these things. We do know one thing, though, that I think is kind of more kind of true to reality, is that young people are getting, young people, particularly young women, adolescent women, teenage girls, are getting very, very anxious and very, very sad. This was a phenomenon first kind of discovered in America and discussed heavily by social psychologists like Jonathan Haidt and Ross Douthat. And, you know, everyone has their own reason for it, but people keep glomming on to this kind of central, the argument that keeps recurring is that young people have phones and phones make young people, particularly teenage girls, really, really miserable.
Very quickly on.
What's interesting, Matt, though, when you do look at the research in relation to happiness, Rory Sutherland, the guy who founded Ogilvy, very interesting in relation to behavioural economics, where he talks about that sense of control, that people often feel happier when they have a sense of control over their lives. And that's what they find when you get past the 40s, which this research suggests, that people have a bit more control over their lives. And I suspect part of the unhappiness element is, if you think about it, for people in their 20s in Ireland and in their 30s, the, for instance, lack of ability to buy your own home, that does give you a sense of lack of control over your own destiny.
Lack of stability.
And then you look at Harvard, have done longitudinal studies into happiness, and one of the things that strikes them is the importance of relationships and the importance of being active in your community. And maybe one of the reasons why Ireland is in the top 20 are because of the strong community feel that we still have, thanks to associations and institutions like the GAA, and that actually we should, as we have touched upon, when we wake up in the morning, thank God that we are living in a place like Ireland.
Owen Tomás McDermott, MD of the Communications Clinic, and Finn McRedmond, columnist for the Irish Times. Thank you.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Weekdays from 4:30. Today.